Today on the 21st show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision to not seek re-election. We'll have the third in our series of conversations. Don Tracy is an attorney and was chairman of the Illinois Republican Party for 3 years, starting in 2021. We'll talk with him live in studio about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and what it'll take to win the nomination of President Donald Trump's Republican Party while also remaining viable for a general election in a blue state. We also want to put your questions to the candidate, so give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Don Tracy for the hour, today on the 21st show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking today with Don Tracy, former chairman of the Illinois Republican Party and a candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate. The current office holder, Dick Durbin, is retiring at the end of his term. Tracy was born in Mount Sterling, a small town in rural western Illinois. He's the oldest of 12 children. He attended Western Illinois University, earned a bachelor's degree in business administration from Arizona State, and got his law degree from the University of Memphis. He's been an attorney for more than 5 decades now, currently senior counsel at Brown, Hay & Stevens, a firm that boasts a young Abraham Lincoln among its former members. Tracy previously ran for lieutenant governor in 2010, and he served as head of the state's gaming board under Governor Bruce Rauner. He is one of 8 Republicans, at least as of the end of the filing period on Monday, that could change, who is seeking the Republican nomination for Senate. Don Tracy joins us live today in our studios in Urbana. Welcome to the 21st show.
I'm glad to be here, but I have to point out I was born in Urbana.
Oh, good to know.
Where we are right now, not Mount Sterling. I grew up in Mount Sterling, but I was born in Urbana. My parents both graduated from the University of Illinois.
Good to know. All right. Thank you for the correction. So let's talk about that. Talk about your early life being born in Urbana, growing up in Mount Sterling.
I don't really remember Urbana because we moved there to Henry, Illinois. I don't remember Henry, Illinois, because I was quite young. I think we moved to Mount Sterling when I was 3 or 4 in like 53 or 54. Lived there a couple years, moved to Dallas, Texas for a couple years, when my dad took a new job. When he was here, he was working for Prairie Farms in his senior year after he returned from the war.
And then dairy cooperative.
He met my mom at the Newman Center here in Champaign or Urbana. And as he put it, and my sisters and brothers, some of my sisters don't hate for me to tell this story, but according to Dad, he saw this young farm girl from Christian County who was struggling to dance, the way he put it. And so he rescued her, I guess, and then they married, and I was born here, and my brother Pat was born here. And he worked for Prairie Farms and doing their newsletter, and so they hired him after he graduated from college with a degree in dairy science. And then Prairie Farms moved him to Henry and then to Mount Sterling, and then he worked in Dallas, Texas, where we lived. I think there were 7 or 8 kids in Dallas at the time. Then we moved back to Mount Sterling to work again for Prairie Farms. And then in 1960, he decided to start his own business, which is the family business now that we have called Dot Foods.
Okay. I'm told by one of our producers that your website does say born and raised in Mount Sterling, so I appreciate the
check. Thank you for
that.
Telling me that.
So
we will correct that.
And we can take it up later. But so you I understand you've had some experience working in a warehouse when you were young. You were a truck driver during college. What did you take from those experiences?
Well, my dad started the business at in 1960 when I was 10 years old. So I like to say I was employee one in the warehouse. And the warehouse at that time was a 2-car garage. And my brother Pat was 9. And since he was younger, I claim that he was employee number 2. Since then, that's when I started working for Dot. And I worked in the warehouse until college summers, and then I drove a truck for the business.
This is Dot Foods, big food distributor. People will have certainly seen their trucks on the highway in Illinois.
It's big now, but it was a very small very basic, thinly capitalized business for decades, really. So then in law school, after I graduated from Arizona State, I came back and I was the only salesman. And I like to tell people it's taken a lot of salesmen to replace me. Of course, the company's a lot bigger than it was then. And I worked my way through law school as a salesman for Dot. And then I started practicing law. And my dad hired me as the company lawyer as soon as I graduated, actually a little bit before. And I've been working as a lawyer for the company ever since. And I'm still doing some work, though I'm semi-retired at this point, and concentrating on this run for the U.S. Senate full time.
Well, let's talk about that then. Why do you want to be a United States senator?
Well, I have a passion for public service. I've been involved in public service for a long time, starting out with, I guess, when I was named president of the Oak Ridge Cemetery in Springfield by Mayor Langfelder at the time, Ossie Langfelder. And that is the second most visited cemetery in the country after Arlington. A lot of people don't know that. And that's because that's where Lincoln's tomb is located. And so I've done a lot of other things like that. Ran for state senate in 2002 as a Democrat. Found out the hard way I'm not a Democrat. I'm a Republican. And then I ran for lieutenant governor in 2010. Then I formed an independent committee to run ads for my sister-in-law, Senator Jill Tracy, who was running with Kirk Dillard as lieutenant governor, Kirk Dillard being the governor candidate for governor and lieutenant governor. When they lost the primary, I then changed that committee to raise money and run radio ads for Governor Rauner and his lieutenant governor, Evelyn Sanguietti. After Tim Schneider resigned as chair of the Illinois Republican Party in 21, in 20, people asked me, suggested I run for that. And so I was elected and I was chairman for about 3.5 years, which I'm told is the average tenure of a state chairman for the Republican Party is about 1.5 years. So I doubled that. But Tim was in there 7 years. But in between, I've helped a lot of candidates throughout Illinois. So I've been active politically. As a community leader, I was president of the Sangamon County Bar Association, president of the Abraham Lincoln Association, president of the Dana Thomas House Association, chairman of the Secretary of State Corporate Advisory Committee, and many other things like that. I just can't remember off the top of my head.
So you mentioned that you ran as a Democrat, and I think you said you learned the hard way that you're not a Democrat. I'm curious, say more about that.
I'm a conservative, and at that time, and certainly before that time, there were a lot of downstate conservative Democrats that were called Blue Dog Democrats. In 2002, that was starting to change. And as a conservative, I found that Republicans who were conservatives would not vote for me because I'm a Democrat, and Democrats wouldn't vote for me because I was a conservative. And so I had the choice. I could either change my values and my principles, or I could change my party. So I chose to change my party.
Do you think that is a long-term good thing or a bad thing? That this is what political scientists call party polarization, right? You don't really have conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans the way you did some years ago.
I think that trend is a bad thing. I think, and it was in Illinois made particularly bad by the cutback amendment. Before the cutback amendment in, I think, 1978, each House district, for example, would have two state reps from the majority party in that district and one from the minority party. So even in the deepest part of red Illinois, you would have at least one Democrat state rep in those districts. And the same thing in Chicago. There would be, where there's hardly any Republican reps now, there would be one in each of the districts up there. And as a result, the reps in those districts had to work together and did work together to represent their district. And they, got to know each other. And there just seemed like there was more cooperation in those days as a result of that, more bipartisanship.
It's a It's one of Pat Quinn's lasting legacies in Illinois, for better and worse.
Well, it is for worse, in my opinion.
Sure. So, all right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Don Tracy, who is a Republican primary candidate for the United States Senate. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. If you have questions for Mr. Tracy, 800-222-9455. All right, I have a number of policy questions I want to get to, because obviously one of the big aspects of being a senator is dealing with policy, particularly foreign policy. Let's start there. It's been 2 years since Hamas attacked Israel, and Israel has been waging war in Gaza. How do you assess the United States' response to October 7th and all that's happened since?
I think it's been measured and appropriate from the very beginning. We don't have boots on the ground there, but Israel has been a very strong ally of ours for many years in the Mideast, and continues to be, and we should support our allies. The United States needs, and I particularly appreciate our efforts to bring peace finally in the Mideast. That is a really hard climb, but it needs to be done. What I'd like to say, when people ask me why I'm so interested in politics, even though I haven't made a, I'm not a career politician, it's not been my career. The jobs I've done in politics don't pay, except gaming board paid $500 a meeting, but it was not quite a full-time job. It was about a half-time job as chair. But as I like to say, politics, I think, are one of the most important human endeavors, because with good politics, you have peace and prosperity. And with bad politics, you have war, death, and destruction. I think it's the most important human good. Politics is the most important human endeavor, the most complex also, aside from war. And politics is the alternative to war.
I agree with that sentiment. You know, I want to stick with this situation in Israel and Gaza, though, because some have called what Israel did there a genocide, right? 64,000 Palestinians, according to the Associated Press, have been killed. What do you think of that characterization?
I think it's absolutely wrong. By the way, do you know how many people died in World War II?
Millions, right? Tens of millions.
Right. The latest estimate I saw was 60 to 90 million. I've been saying 50 million for years, but I guess that revision, that has been revised upward. Now, war is awful, and there's always collateral damage in war. And I have heard from others who have studied this far more than me is that Israel, and defending itself and responding to the October 7th Hamas attack, brutal attack, has done a better job of minimizing collateral damage than almost any other warring nation in a war of this consequence. I know people may disagree with that because, today wars are more televised. There's more information, so we're more aware of the collateral damage to war. But if you want to look to a war where there's a lot of collateral damage, look at World War II.
Speaking of Europe, where World War II was often, or at least part of it, was centered for the American imagination, at least, does the United States have an interest in a free Ukraine?
Well, I think so.
Not everybody in the Republican Party seems to share that view these days.
I think there is some divergence of opinion there. Probably not as black and white as your question suggests. But I personally believe we cannot allow Putin to win that war. I certainly hope we don't have to have boots on the ground there, and I should do everything possible to avoid that. But we cannot let, in my opinion, Putin win that war. If he does and takes over Ukraine, then an aggressive nation, obviously Russia is very aggressive. They invaded Crimea under President Obama, and then they invaded the Ukraine under President Biden. So they've proven they're an aggressive nation. Kind of like Germany was in the 1930s. And if we allow them to take over, if they're successful at taking over Ukraine, then they are on NATO borders. And then we will have an absolute duty to go in, to go to war with Russia if they cross that border. So Ukraine's a good buffer, we need to make sure Russia does not conquer Ukraine.
Make the case to younger voters, maybe who don't have the background of the Cold War and the experience that some of us grew up with of, you know, the threat from Russia or the Soviet Union before, who, you know, were, I think a lot of people were enamored of President Trump's idea that that's not our business. We need to get out of Europe. We need to get out of NATO. Europe's not doing enough for its own security. How do you make the case that to people that this is something that it's valuable for America to continue pursuing, especially younger Republican voters?
I think the better analogy or precedent is World War II, not the Cold War. In World War II, Hitler started out small, conquering, I think, the Alsace-Lorraine area, France, because France did not resist. And people have to remember that about 20 or 30 million died in World War I. It was just an awful, awful war, trench warfare. All these, you know, vibrant young men living and dying underground in these trenches, bombarded by artillery constantly. The flower of the youth of Europe was destroyed for an entire generation in that war. So when Hitler started taking over Germany and then started advancing on based on various claims of rightful ownership, like to Alsace-Lorraine, which they've been fighting over, I think, for centuries, France didn't want to fight another world war. England didn't want to fight another world war. So they did not push back there. So then he went into Austria, and they didn't push back. But then Czechoslovakia had a big standing army. Do we need to take a break?
We do need to take a break, yes. We will continue this conversation with Don Tracy. I'm sorry, we are on a fixed clock on our program today. So we are speaking with Don Tracy, candidate for United States Senate, or for the Republican nomination, I should say. We'll be right back.
Support for the 21st Show comes from the Des Moines Arts Center, presenting Manuel Alvarez Bravo, a pioneer of Mexican photography, featuring collaborators like Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and more. On view through January 18th. More information at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking for the hour today with Don Tracy, who is a candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate in Illinois. As you know, the current office holder, Dick Durbin, is retiring at the end of his present term. If you want to join us today, if you have a question for Don Tracy, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. So before the break, and I had to so rudely interrupt you, we were talking about the making the case for especially a younger generation who maybe doesn't see the value of NATO as the president seems to not necessarily see the value of NATO today. And you were talking about the cost of World War I and World War II. And I'll let you finish your thought, please.
All right. Well, as I was saying, Hitler started out small, took over Germany and then Alsace-Lorraine, which was a disputed territory between Germany and France for many, many decades, if not centuries. Then he took over Austria, and then he was threatening Czechoslovakia based on the claim that there were a lot of German-speaking peoples in Czechoslovakia. And France and England in particular had been exhausted by World War I. They had lost the flower of their youth. They did not want to go to war with Germany again. Neville Chamberlain, who was then prime minister, went on a peace mission to Munich, Germany, to meet with Hitler and try to resolve his claims to Czechoslovakia, and made the decision to surrender, basically agree with Hitler that if he would promise not to invade anybody else, the English and the French would not defend Czechoslovakia. And at the time, Czechoslovakia had like a million-man army. It was a powerful force. And with help from England and Britain, a lot of people think Hitler could have been stopped then. But Chamberlain made the deal. went back to England and said, we now have peace in our time because we made a deal with Hitler to stop the Germany advances through Europe. Churchill was out of office at the time, in the wilderness, as they say, and his response was to Mr. Chamberlain, at Munich, you were given a choice between war and dishonor. You chose dishonor, and you shall have war. And of course, basically, Chamberlain appeased Hitler, and as Churchill put it, that's like feeding the crocodile in the hopes of being the last one to be devoured by the crocodile.
Do you see a parallel with what Putin is doing and what Hitler was doing?
And Hitler went, you know, obviously went on to invade Poland and Russia. Well, that is a concern, you know, because he took over Crimea, he wants to take over Ukraine. So what guarantees would we have that he would stop there? So yeah, that worries me.
Yeah. You know, back in February, sticking with this idea of foreign policy, special government employee Elon Musk, quote, spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper. Was that a good move for America?
Well, based on the reports that I heard, there were a lot of grants going to USAID that did not seem to serve the national interest. So, I obviously didn't do an audit of all the grants.
Sure.
I'm not one to say we should never do any foreign aid, but I do believe, as I think Secretary Rubio said, that foreign aid needs to be clearly in the interest of the United States and not to support a particular ideology or spread a particular ideology throughout the world.
We had a question from a listener. This is Jesse in Mattoon. Wanted to ask if you, I'm just going to read from it here, quote, support targeting non-combatant vessels on international waters using deadly military force.
Depends on the intelligence and the basis for that. I think in the 1800s, there were the Barbary pirates out there, and we were targeting them, the U.S. Navy was, because they were raiding commerce. Here, the allegation, what the Trump administration is saying, as I understand it, is that these Venezuelan boats, gunboats, whatever they are actually part of the delivery system for the fentanyl coming into our country that is killing tens of thousands of Americans. So I assume that's true. I assume that the administration has a lot more intelligence than I have about it. Then that would be the justification for it.
It's been my understanding that most of the fentanyl comes across the border from Mexico or in shipping containers from China. But even so, has the administration been forthcoming enough about the evidence for, you know, Congress, where you're running to be a senator, to properly do oversight of those activities?
Well, I would hope that if I am successful in this race and I become a U.S. senator, that there will be some confidential briefings that I would get on that, and that would have a heck of a lot more knowledge about that than I do now. I just don't know. And I trust the administration. If you don't trust the administration, of course you want more information.
Yeah. Okay. One of the other constitutional roles of a United States senator is to advise and confirm the president's nominations for cabinet secretaries and many other positions, judges. What do you think of President Trump's cabinet selections so far?
I wasn't a fan of Matt Gaetz nomination.
the one who didn't make it through.
All right.
For Attorney General.
Yeah. I'm particularly pleased with Scott Bessent, Howard Lutnick, Brooke Collins, Marco Rubio. I think, you know, the jury's still out on Secretary of War Hegseth, but I generally like what he's doing.
In what way? Say more about that.
I'm focusing on the military as being a lethal fighting force, as being capable of defending the country and waging war. War is a terrible, dirty business, but you need people that are trained to do that, trained to kill people, basically. And it just seemed to me that under Biden, there were distractions in the military based on social issues that, that
is Black History Month, that sort of thing.
That took away from the mission. I don't know all the distractions, but Hegstra seems laser focused on training soldiers to kill. And it's a harsh thing to say, but that is the job of a soldier.
What about Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr., who was not a Republican until it seems that he joined the administration?
My son is a probably shouldn't bring my family in this, but he's a independent and he's been selling RFK to me for some time now. He homeschools his children, I was surprised, at that. But I like a lot of people, lost a lot of faith in the medical community during the COVID crisis, I think, and a lot of political leaders. I think they delegated way too much power to the medical community. And I think there were representations made by the national medical community that certain things about medicine were settled when they really weren't, and they quashed dissenting opinions. As a lawyer, I believe in majority and dissenting opinions, and I don't think I don't think dissenting opinions should be quashed. So I think the medical community, based on the COVID experience, which involved masking small children and letting school stay out for way too long, which I think has set back a lot of children for a year or more, maybe some permanently. I think the medical establishment needed to be sort of shook up a little bit, maybe disrupted a little bit. Not of course destroyed or anything like that. We have one of the best medical systems in the world, but I think every now and then systems need to be examined in detail and perhaps changed. And so I see RFK as an agent of change. And now, will he be? Should he change everything? Of course not.
Childhood vaccinations?
Will he make some mistakes? Possibly. Well, if he were to say no more ever childhood vaccinations, I think that'd be a big mistake. But if he's going to challenge certain vaccines on a case-by-case basis and do some maybe more studies on them, I think that's good. I think we've probably accepted some things over time that maybe shouldn't have been accepted. It does seem strange that we have so much autism now and so much mental illness now that we didn't have when I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Or at least if maybe we had it, we just didn't know about it.
Well, that's the thing, right? Are we open to the idea that maybe it's just much more diagnosed now?
I am, but I think that ought to be part of the study and the inquiry.
A comedian recently said,
I believe in challenges. I think things, even longstanding policies should be challenged. But I don't believe in just throwing everything out, the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah. I also want to ask about, time is ticking away here. The Justice Department, you've certainly seen the price of corruption here in Illinois over the years. The Justice Department, by all reports, is sort of pivoting away from investigating political corruption. The FBI has disbanded an elite unit tasked with investigating members of Congress and federal agencies. The public integrity section of the Justice Department was reduced from 30 lawyers to 5 and lost the power to file its own cases. Is that an appropriate direction for federal prosecutors?
Yes, we've certainly experienced a lot of corruption in Illinois. I saw an estimate that in the 42 years, I think Madigan was House Speaker, about 2,000 Democrat Chicago politicians were indicted and convicted, about an average of one a week. I obviously think the Justice Department needs to be involved in corruption because most of those cases were brought by the federal Justice Department in operations like Gray Lord, where they found that judges were fixing murder cases and divorce cases. I mean, horrible. Horrible stuff. In other words, I think Operation Silver Shovel. I forget which industry that involved. So, the Justice Department, based on what they did with the Russian collusion hoax, which I think was one of the worst scandals and least reported scandals in the history of our country, and the lawfare waged by the Biden Justice Department. I think there needs to be some changes at the Justice Department, but the Justice Department should not be abandoning its mission of pursuing official corruption cases throughout the country.
What do you mean lawfare waged by the Biden Justice Department? Say more about that.
Well, I guess everybody has their own definition of lawfare. From what I have I've heard is that the justice that there was some collaboration with Prosecutor Bragg in New York and the prosecutor in Georgia and the Justice Department right after the president announced that he was going to run for re-election, the current president. And I think I've heard that there was some communications with Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York. And the timing of all that is very very suspect. And
So the idea would be, as I'm sorry, I'm not aware of this particular story, that the Justice Department was coordinating with to influence a local prosecutor?
Some people there. And in fact, I've heard that one of the top officials in the Biden Justice Department left at that time to work for either Letitia James or Alvin Bragg. I forget which one. And I don't like lawfare on either side.
I say, is it equally a problem that the president is sending Truth Social messages on his to the attorney general that we got to indict James Comey now? I'm paraphrasing.
Well, if the Comey indictment is lawfare, then I don't like it. I would be opposed to that. I don't know what the evidence is. I hope it needs to be strong evidence for that sort of thing, because I don't
A jury will decide that. But I'm asking about the president sending the message to the attorney general.
Well, you know, the president, presidents have a right to free speech, just like anybody else. I would hope that the Justice Department acts, however, not on things like tweets or posts, social media posts, but instead acts on the evidence. I do think that Comey was irresponsible in his intervention in the 2016 campaign with the Hillary Clinton emails. I think he was irresponsible in relative to the Russian collusion hoax and other aspects, too. But does that rise to the level of a crime? That I don't know. But I don't like lawfare on either side of the aisle. I don't like impeachments, political impeachments, basically a legal slash political proceeding. That is, you know, masquerading for pure politics. I didn't like the Clinton impeachment, and I didn't like the Trump impeachments. I think impeachments should be reserved for truly high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm. I want to play a listener voicemail now. This is about an aspect of Senate governance. We don't have too much time here, so maybe we'll start an answer and then come back to it after the break, about 2 minutes until our break. But let's listen to this.
This is Sam from Springfield. My question for Mr. Tracy is this. The Republicans have a majority of the U.S. Senate. They could easily, by a majority vote, repeal the filibuster rule and end the government shutdown. Now, if you were in the Senate now, would you vote to repeal the filibuster? And if, when you're elected to the Senate, if the filibuster rule is still in existence, would you vote to repeal the rule?
That sounds like Sam Canman, a friend of mine, a strong Democrat, but nevertheless a friend of mine. I believe the filibuster is very important for long-term stable government. I would oppose using the filibuster or using the nuclear option to destroy the
and
filibuster.
The filibuster, yeah.
To end the filibuster. And if I have time,
yeah,
I,
you have, go ahead.
But I think the Democrats are abusing the filibuster, certainly in this situation. I don't know that a filibuster has ever been used to shut down the government in lieu of passing a clean resolution. And I hope most people understand that a majority of the House and a majority of the U.S. Senate do not want the government shut down and a majority of U.S. senators would vote to pass the clean resolution, which is needed to open the government, to keep the government funding at current Biden budget levels. But it's the Democrat filibuster that has shut down the government. So, but no, as a U.S. senator, I would vote to keep the filibuster. I think it's really important. Otherwise, we have a yo-yo government. Every time, you know, the power changes in Washington.
Yeah. All right. We're going to have to take a break there. We will continue with Don Tracy, Republican candidate for, or I should say, nomination for the, a candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate. This is the 21st Show. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. We'll be right back. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking today with Don Tracy, who is running for United States Senate, seeking the Republican nomination to be in the election to pick a successor for United States Senator Dick Durbin, who is ending his long career when his term expires in early 2027. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. We have John calling from Springfield. John, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I just had a question for Mr. Tracy. When he was a younger guy coming up, raising a family, coming up through the ranks, if he could have ever imagined supporting someone like Donald Trump.
All right. Well, Donald Trump is the duly elected president of the United States. He's been elected twice. He is a unique person in terms of how he communicates. But by and large, as I tell people, when you vote for presidents, you're really voting, your choice is not so much the personalities, though that's what the media focuses on. It is the you're voting for a Republican administration or a Democrat administration. And in the old days, it seemed like there wasn't that much difference between Republican and Democrat administrations. But now that the parties are so polarized, there is a huge difference in the administrations. So for the most part, I think the president has really been a typical Republican president in terms of his cabinet members and in terms of his policies.
You really think like Mitt Romney or John McCain, you think that pretty much would have gone like the Romney administration or the McCain administration would have gone like the Trump administration?
I was about to say the difference is the current President Trump is more of an agent of change, and I don't know that a President Romney or a President McCain would have been agents of change as much as President Trump is. And for example, I think President Biden was very much an agent of change, or whoever was running the Biden administration. I mean, who would have thought that we would ever have open borders? It wasn't that long ago when President Obama was called the deporter in chief. And my understanding is that he deported, I think, 3 million in his first term, more than President Trump deported in his first term. And there are lots of quotes by Schumer and Biden and others, I think maybe even Obama, saying that, you need to have a real nation, you have to have a border, and you have to enforce the immigration law. But now things have changed so much, and so Trump finds himself with 10 to 20 million illegal immigrants that flowed through this open border, and now he has to do something about that.
How would you rate the job on that topic then, scale of 1 to 10, that immigration enforcement and the Border Patrol are doing in Chicago and the suburbs, and now we're even seeing in some downstate communities here in Illinois?
I think it depends on where you are. I as you noted, I went to law school in Memphis, and I was a salesman for a family business before that in the Memphis area. Not a resident, but passing through there, spending a lot of time there. And then I practiced law there after law school for four years in Memphis. And Memphis has cooperated with federal immigration law enforcement. And they've, as a result, arrested a lot of gang members and a lot of criminals. They have also taken a lot of firearms off the street. They have made Memphis a safer place. And they've also found over 80 missing children. People forget that a lot of the people came across the border during the Biden open borders policy are missing. Thousands and thousands of them are still missing. And so they have found a lot of those in Memphis. So that has been a lot smoother operation. But in Chicago, you know, we have a governor and we have a mayor that not only are they not cooperating with federal law enforcement, but they seem to be actually inciting resistance to arrest and even assaults on federal law enforcement officers. And so, and that's created a lot of chaos. You can't expect law enforcement to just take, you know, have people throw rocks and bottles at them and block them in and slash their tires and do nothing. And so they've had to respond with tear gas and things like that. And so then you get chaos from that.
But it's not just the governor and the mayor who are opposed to what immigration enforcement is doing here. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of voters, people you would need the votes of, presumably, to become the next United States senator in Illinois, who don't like to see the agents wearing masks and, you know, no name tags, not identifying themselves and taking the, you know, tamale vendor off the street, that sort of thing. You know, criminals is one thing. Tamale vendors, contractors, people gardening, things like that maybe is another.
Well, I don't think there's a majority of Illinoisans would say we should have open borders and we should not enforce immigration
sure.
law.
I think, what about would the majority of Illinoisans support, you know, people in these camouflage getups with masks and not identifying themselves,
taking people off the street? Probably not the way the media has painted it, but if they understand that if they would compare the Memphis enforcement action, where there is cooperation with local law enforcement, to the Chicago situation, I think you'd find out the problem is not with the federal law enforcement tactics. The problem is with the resistance in Chicago led by Governor Pritzker and Mayor Mayor Johnson. A lot of people, but I do believe a majority of Americans or Illinoisans probably think that there should be something in the form, some immigration reform, and I would be there, and it would have to be bipartisan. Hmm. And one thing that has been suggested that I would certainly want to study and be and possibly open to, and that is a legal path, not to citizenship, not to voting, but a legal path to legal residency, you know, for workers in particular, for people that have been here a long time, 10 years or something like that. They've been law-abiding, paid their taxes, willing to pay some form of restitution for breaking the law and entering the country.
That seems to be a point of difference with the Trump administration, which is just looking to get as many people out as they can.
Well, maybe it now, because right now they're focused on enforcement because they're dealing with the 10 to 20 million brought in under the open borders and resistance, outright resistance against the federal government in the big blue city. So, you know, I would suspect that once that phase is over and they get the worst of the worst out of here, make these cities safer, as they're making Memphis safer, that I would hope they would turn to addressing that issue and looking for some kind of bipartisan a solution to the, you know, the vast majority of illegal immigrants that have been law-abiding citizens.
I can't believe we only have about 7 minutes left on the show today. We need to do like one of those 3-hour podcasts that I keep hearing about. I want to ask you about a couple of other issues, one of which is January 6th, 2021. What did you think of what happened that day? And what do you think of all the blanket pardons that happened for the people who stormed the Capitol?
Well, it was a horrible event. It was, in my opinion, it was a riot by a bunch of knuckleheads. I think the president had authorized the National Guard to be out there. They should have had better enforcement. The Capitol Police were not ready for it. Seems like they should have had better security under the circumstances at that time. It was not the president's finest hour, I will say. I think he should have acted sooner, to at least. I mean, he told and it's been misreported, but and it's been called an insurrection. It was not an insurrection. It was a bunch of knuckleheads. You know, some people, you know, taking selfies, you know, being inside the Capitol and all that.
And some people but spraying bear spray at police officers.
There were some agitators. There were some bad apples in there. The vast majority were not bad apples, and I don't think should have been prosecuted. Some of them should have been. Those who committed violence against Capitol Police should have been prosecuted. I think that was appropriate. But I think the prosecution was overzealous, and I wish they'd gone after the mob. I wish the Biden administration had gone after all the criminals that they let in this country through the open border policy, the way they went after the mostly the law-abiding citizens, you know, people that never had a criminal record the way they did. But what's misreported often is that President Trump, in his speech, he's been accused of inciting that riot, but he said march to the Capitol and peacefully protest is what he said.
And you've got to fight for your country
and,
if you want it.
Well, but he emphasized peaceful protest and fighting. I mean, everybody, Democrat politicians, you know, we all say fight, you know, that means fight, you know, ballot wise by protesting. I mean, that's what they're saying about, you know, ICE, you know, get to fight ICE. And I don't think that is inciting, you know, assaults. But some of the other things like Pritzker calling federal law enforcement thugs and Nazis and Gestapo, I do think that is inciting, resisting arrest and maybe even assaulting officers. So January 6th was a terrible day in our country. Not the president's finest hour, certainly not.
Was it wrong for him not to accept the election results? Who do you think won the 2020 election?
Well, Biden was the elected, the duly elected president. But
fairly elected.
Well,
yeah, or no?
he was duly elected by the rules of the time. But I do not agree it was the most secure election ever. You know, we went from having, basically a handful of mail-in votes, a few thousands, you know, to millions of mail-in votes overnight without
because of a pandemic.
Because of the pandemic, without proper safeguards. And the Democrats took advantage of that throughout the country in important areas like Michigan by waiving the only election integrity guideline or guardrail you have for mail-in batting, which is signature verification, by waiving signature verification. So, and then there was, I think, $450 million of what they call Zuckerbucks invested into what some people think was letting Democrat operatives into election offices and running their get-out-the-vote operation from there. There was the Hunter Biden black laptop, I guess collusion by 51, allegedly, security experts. There was just a lot of things about that election that people have written books on, like Molly Hemingway. Nevertheless, the default rule is if you can't prove election fraud sufficient to set aside an election within 2 weeks, it's done. It's over with. So Biden was legally elected and has served out his term.
Just a couple of minutes left, and I do want to end on this note because a lot of people who've been in Illinois Republican politics as long as you have, a lot of them don't think it's their party anymore, right? Jim Edgar used to say this, the late Jim Edgar, last time I talked to him before the last election. I've heard similar sentiments from others. Is this still your Republican Party, or is MAGA the future of Republican Party? Are you MAGA? How do you see that? How do you think about that? And I'm sorry to say we only have about 90 seconds left.
As state chairman, I promoted a big tent of Republican Party for all wings of the party, and I still do. We have a lot of differences in our party. I worked for I was on the Edgar, I think, Corporate Acts Advisory Committee when he was Secretary of State. I was a friend of Jim Edgar's. I went to his funeral, and I thought he was a great governor. He became towards the end, I think, a bit liberal. I think he endorsed a Democrat for president, which I never thought that would happen. But he was a good man, and I consider him a friend. And I think he was one of our best governors ever.
And do you think, I mean, you will win the support of the MAGA Republican Party? Your pitch to them?
Well, you know, I people use that term all the time. I'm not sure exactly what it means. I hope to win the support of all Republicans and all independents in this election, because to win this in a state that is currently blue, that I'm trying to turn at least purple by winning one of the 8 statewide seats, I'm going to need votes from not just Republicans, but also independent voters.
Don Tracy is a candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate here in Illinois. The election is coming up next year. This is the third in our series of conversations we've been having. You can also hear our interviews with Juliana Stratton and the Lieutenant Governor of Illinois and Robin Kelly, Congresswoman, who are seeking the nomination on the Democratic side. We will have more now that the filing period is done. There were 22 people who filed. I suspect there will not be that number actually on the ballot next spring, but we will start working through more of those candidates here on the 21st Show. Let us know what you thought about our conversation. Talk@21stshow.org is our email address. Excuse me. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.